hope you recognise the following exchange. "Oh," said Susan, "I thought Aslan was a man. Is he quite safe? I shall feel rather nervous about meeting a lion." "That you will, dearie, and no mistake," said Mrs. Beaver. "If there's anyone who can appear before Aslan without their knees knocking, they're either braver than most or else just silly." "Then he isn't safe," said Lucy. "Safe?" said Mr. Beaver. "Don't you hear what Mrs. Beaver tells you? Who said anything about safe? Of course he isn't safe. But he's good. He's the king, I tell you." The Bible is first and foremost a book about God. Before there was anything else, God was. After this world has ceased to exist, God will be. He is the ground of being. He is the source of our existence and of the existence of everything else. He is the one with whom we have to do. Unfortunately, much talk and much thinking these days either seeks to domesticate God because he makes us nervous, or else to ignore him, suggesting we have found our way here without him, or to relativize him, to suggest that there are other gods worth similar attention. For the truth is, when it comes to believing in God, Christianity is in a class of its own. Why? Simply because our God is in a class of his own. There's no one like him. When you set the Ark of the Covenant representing God's presence beside the image of a Philistine god, strange things happen. And as we begin to move into a fresh new year, what better person to concentrate our minds on? For to quote the words of a previous king in this country, we need a light, indeed the light of the Word of God, that we may tread safely into the unknown. In these two chapters from which we read earlier, we encounter the God Mr. Beaver speaks of. God who is not safe, but good. And that's our title for today. God who is not safe, but good. The God we need for every situation we'll find ourselves in this coming year. If we would serve him and trust him, we need to know who he is and how he works. And we can't look at every verse in these two chapters, but we can get an idea of how God is working here if we divide the passage into three parts. First of all, the Lord humbles Dagon. That's just an idea of what's going on. I'm not sure if the whole of Dagon fell to the ground or if it was just the upper parts. We'll just talk a wee bit more about that in a minute or two. The Lord humbles Dagon. And really, we've jumped into the middle of this history. We need a little background. I've said before that when God was giving these words to whoever put these chapters together, now Samuel hasn't signed them, so we don't know for sure, but Samuel could well have been the source of this material. At that time, there was no such thing as bold type, or italics or asterisks to highlight what was most important. Instead, God uses repetition. Now, it doesn't always come across in the English. But in chapter 4, which we didn't read earlier, God repeats the same verb 6 times and 3 more times in the first 3 verses of chapter 5. It's the verb to take. In those 9 places, the ESV does sometimes use the word took, But the NIV only uses the word took once out of those nine occasions. Both versions most often use the word captured. So when you see the word captured in chapter 4, that's the word we're thinking about. Just follow through some of these references with me, because they'll give you, it's a kind of a framework. They'll give you an idea of what's going on. It seems at the beginning of chapter 4 that the Israelites are under the thumb of the Philistines. So at the beginning of chapter 4, they decide to throw off the Philistine yoke. But it doesn't work, and they're defeated. So someone has the bright idea of bringing the Ark of the Covenant into battle with them. The Ark is that wooden box. Now, it's not very big. If you use imperial measures, it's about 4'4" by 2'6" by 2'6". That's the size of it. So it's not a very big box. It's a rectangular box. Or 130 centimetres by 80 centimetres by 80 centimetres, if you prefer metric. It's covered with gold. It's carried on poles by the Levites and no one else. And it normally stays in the tabernacle in Shiloh. It contains the two tablets of stone where God had written the Ten Commandments. If you remember, the priests carrying the ark went first into the rushing river Jordan, and God stopped the river's flow. The priests stood there so that the people could cross over into the promised land on dry ground. And again, the priests carrying the ark go first around the walls of Jericho before God brings down those mighty walls. The first example of the verb to take in chapter 4 is in verse 3. Let's just look there. When the soldiers returned to camp, the elders of Israel asked, "Why did the Lord bring defeat upon us today before the Philistines? Let us bring," and that's take, "let us take the Ark of the Lord's Covenant from Shiloh so that it may go with us and save us from the hand of our enemies." So some Israelite is reasoning. We have lost the battle because we didn't have God with us. Let's not make that mistake again. Let's take him into battle with us the next time. And really, they're using the Ark rather like a lucky charm. Because as Solomon will say a little bit further on in the Bible, the day that the new temple is being dedicated, Solomon says in prayer to God, "The heavens, even the highest heaven, cannot contain you, Lord. How much less this temple, this magnificent temple I have built." So if the temple can't contain God, how can this small box contain God? It doesn't house God so that God lives there and nowhere else. But God is pleased for his presence to dwell there. The Israelites cheer to see the ark come among them. And the Philistines who hear the cheer are quaking in their boots. But then God does something quite unexpected, and this is part of who God is. You can read about it in the second use of the verb to take, chapter 4, verse 11. The ark of God was captured, was taken, and Eli's two sons, Hophni and Phinehas, died. God allows the ark to be taken. It seems that Eli's sons are close by the ark. They may even be carrying it. They may expect it to give them some form of protection. But as we saw last week, they are wicked men. They are sons of the devil. So they're mistaken. Why should God protect those who don't know him or trust him? Old Eli fears for the ark. He knows there's something wrong with using it like this. But either he hasn't spoken out those fears, or else he's been overruled. Look at the third time The verb to take occurs in verse 17. The man who brought the news replied, Israel fled before the Philistines, and the army has suffered heavy losses. Also, your two sons, Hophni and Phinehas, are dead, and the ark of God has been captured, has been taken. These are terrible pieces of news. Defeat, in fact, total rout for the army, the death of his two sons, but the worst actually seems to be the last. The ark of God, and each time that's how it's described, the ark of God has been taken. And that's what causes Eli's death, if you look at verse 18. And that's also what causes Eli's daughter-in-law, Phinehas' wife, to go into labor. And notice the taking of the ark is mentioned first in chapter 4, verse 19. His daughter-in-law, the wife of Phinehas, was pregnant and near the time of delivery when she heard the news that the ark of God had been captured, and the other two pieces of news as well. And twice more before the chapter is over, on her dying lips, it's not so much the fact that her father-in-law is dead, or even that her husband is dead. Those are severe blows. But it's the fact that the ark of God has been taken. It's why she mourns as she's doing. Look at the very last verse of the chapter. She said, the glory has departed from Israel, for the ark of God has been taken. On two levels, this is terrible. On the physical level, the ark of the covenant is the most precious object in Israel. Because it's covered with gold, because it has golden angels on top, it's practically priceless. It's like losing your wedding ring if you're married, or like losing a most expensive present from someone you love if you're not married. And on the spiritual level, the deeper level, this means that the Israelites have lost God. That's certainly what they seem to understand by it. The ark represents God. God has been taken. God has been defeated. God is no longer there to protect them. How foolish they were to use him like this. What a tragedy this is. If you were watching any of the recent World Cup, you may have seen players going down in the penalty area rather easily from time to time, with minimal contact from the defender, even though the cameras were on them, trying to deceive the referee into winning a penalty for their team. You and I can do the same thing without actually going onto a football pitch. We can use God to get what we want without keeping his rules, without honouring him in everything. And if that is our game, God may allow defeat of some kind into our lives to let us see that he won't be used like that. To let us grasp that he is not safe. He often does things that are unexpected, but that he is good through and through. Look on now to chapter 5. After the Philistines had captured, and again that's the word take, had taken the ark of God, they took it from Ebenezer to Ashdod, and that's actually not the verb to take. NIV is a wee bit perverse there. Then they carried the ark, and again that's they took, into Dagon's temple and set it beside Dagon. The Philistines take the ark to their capital city, Ashdod, and they take the ark into the temple of their god Dagon. It's like bringing Dagon a captive. They've bought into the Israelites' faulty view of God. They think they have the Israelites' God in a box. They think they've won. They're bringing the Israelites' God to their God, Dagon, so that he might serve Dagon. But they're in for a shock as well. Look at verse 3. When the people of Ashdod rose early the next day, there was Dagon, fallen on his face on the ground, before the ark of the Lord. They took Dagon, and that's the first time the NIV uses the word take in the right place for the verb to take. They took Dagon and put him back in his place. And that's an actual ironic use of the word. The Philistines enter the temple on Dagon's day of glory to find that he's down on his face worshipping the one true God. And there is some, as I say, irony, maybe even humor at this point. The writer is poking fun at Dagon. His own people have to take him and lift him up and put him back in his place. He can't even lift himself off the ground. But there's worse to come. Look at verse 4. But the following morning, when they rose, there was Dagon fallen on his face on the ground before the ark of the Lord. His head and hands had been broken off and were lying on the threshold. Only his body remained. The Philistines were a seafaring people. Dagon, as that picture would suggest, is shaped something like a merman, with the head and the arms and the torso of a man and the lower body of a fish. That's why we don't make an image of God, because God doesn't belong to this world. There's nothing in this world that can properly or fully represent him. And what happens here in verse 4 is actually the punishment that some pagan nations reserve for those they had conquered. They would take some of their enemy, they would cut off their heads, or they would cut off the palms of their hands. God does this to the lifeless image of Dagon, showing who has actually won. How embarrassing. How humiliating. If Dagon cannot even keep his head on, how can he hear the prayers of his people? How can he ever help them, let alone save them or rescue them? Look at verse 5. That is why to this day, neither the priests of Dagon nor any others who enter Dagon's temple at Ashdod step on the threshold where the hands and the head seem to have landed. So a superstition builds up. But this superstition won't restore Dagon's reputation. It'll only remind the Philistines of when and where their God was broken into pieces. All very interesting as a story. What is God saying in all of this? The Philistines certainly don't seem to have a problem with having two gods in the one temple. But God will have none of it. He's saying in no uncertain terms that he is God and there is no other. Last Lord's Day, I was saying I was hoping to preach today from a chapter of Isaiah. Unfortunately, 1 Samuel took over. But I do want you to turn with me just for a moment. Keep your finger in 1 Samuel and just turn over with me to Isaiah chapter 46. It's on page 784 if you're using these maroon Bibles. Isaiah 46 and verse 6. And these chapters of Isaiah in the 40s do really give us a very full view of who God actually is. So Isaiah 46 verse 6. Some pour out gold from their bags and weigh out silver on the scales. They hire a goldsmith to make it into a god, and they bow down and worship it. They lift it to their shoulders and carry it. They set it up in its place, and there it stands. From that spot, it cannot move. Though one cries out to it, it does not answer. It cannot save him from his troubles. And this is how the Philistines treat Dagon. Such a god can't move. He can't hear, so he can't answer. And he can't save. Now, I don't believe that any of us here today is worshipping a physical idol like Dagon. But we might have an extra god up our sleeves, just in case the true God lets us down. It may be our own wisdom. It may be our own safety or security that we're worshipping more than we're worshipping the one true God. Or it may be smoothing some of the edges of this totalitarian God that we've been reading about. This God who brooks no rivals. Whatever that extra God that we may have is, be sure of this. You'll find it on its mouth and nose in bits before the God of heaven and earth. I just want to encourage you as this new year begins to take verses 8 and 9 of Isaiah 46 to heart. Let me just read those verses. Isaiah 46, verse 8. Remember this, fix it in mind. Take it to heart, you rebels. Isaiah doesn't mince his words. Remember the former things, those of long ago. I am God, and there is no other. I am God, and there is no one like me. And that's really the message that God is declaring in that temple in Philistia that day. So that's the first point. The Lord humbles Dagon. The Lord humbles Dagon. Secondly, the Lord brings down his heavy hand. The Lord brings down his heavy hand. The opening five verses do have their amusing side. But what happens next is far from funny. Look at chapter 5, verse 6. The Lord's hand was heavy upon the people of Ashdod and its vicinity. He brought devastation upon them and afflicted them with tumors. Then, when the men of Ashdod saw what was happening, they said, "The ark of the God of Israel must not stay here with us, because his hand is heavy upon us and upon Dagon, our God." We've looked at one repeated word already. There's another phrase that we find once in chapter 4, five times in chapter 5, and at least three times in chapter 6. That phrase is the Lord's hand. Let's just look back to chapter 4, verse 8 for a moment, to that use of it. Chapter 4, verse 8. This is the Philistine speaking. Woe to us! Who will deliver us from the hand of these mighty gods? They are the gods who struck the Egyptians with all kinds of plagues in the desert. So the Philistines have knowledge, some knowledge of the history of the Israelites. People around you may grasp more about God than you think. Now, they're thinking about many gods, that the Israelites have many gods, not one true God. And they seem to think that the plagues took place in the desert. And yes, certainly the Egyptians were drowned on the edge of the desert. But the plagues took place in the major cities. But the Philistines rightly believe that some greater being is fighting for the Israelites against their enemies. The next use of the word hand or hands is again an ironic one. We've seen in chapter 5, verse 4, where Dagon loses his hands. God doesn't need physical hands in order to cut off Dagon's hands. God may only have to think the thought, and it is done. Look at chapter 5, verse 6. The Lord's hand was heavy upon the people of Ashdod and its vicinity. He brought devastation upon them and afflicted them with tumors. You can see from verse 7, whenever the Philistines are calling out or reporting about what's going on, they get this exactly right. They know why they're suffering. The God they thought they had beaten isn't dead after all. And Dagon can't help them. They have to act themselves. And so the Ark of the God of Israel, as they call it now, is moved to Gath. Gath is where Goliath comes from. We hope to look at him next week. The Philistines may think the giants of Gath can better handle this trouble. But look what happens next in verse 9. But after they had moved it, the Lord's hand was against that city, Gath, throwing it into a great panic. He afflicted the people of that city, both young and old, with an outbreak of tumors. Neither the big people nor the smaller people can bring any relief. So again, the ark is moved to Ekron this time, right on Israel's border. But like moving it from Belfast to Derry or from Belfast to Newry, as close to the border as possible without crossing it. The ark may still prove useful to them, so they don't want to let it go quite yet. But again, God's hand is heavy against Ekron. Look at chapter 5, verse 11. So they called together all the rulers of the Philistines and said, "Send the ark of the God of Israel away. Let it go back to its own place, or it will kill us and our people." For death had filled the city with panic. God's hand was very heavy upon it. Now, it's not very clear what the devastation is. It does involve tumors, unpleasant, painful, even life-threatening growths. And if you read into chapter 6, there's a mention of rats or mice. Some people think that this is bubonic plague. At any rate, it's like the plagues God brought on Pharaoh and his people back in Egypt. By the end of chapter 5, it is very serious. People's lives are at stake. We cannot afford to play around with this God. Death is stalking the Philistine streets. And you can understand the panic in a superstitious nation. It's something like how the people react to Jesus when he casts the horde of demons into the pigs. They don't come round Jesus and congratulate him because this man Legion is in his right mind now. Instead, they ask him to leave. They would rather have the pigs alive and Legion howling in the graveyards. It's a bit like the coming of COVID-19 to this country. Many people just wanted to shut themselves away. Many people didn't want to think about serious illness or even death. So many were expecting to live much longer and didn't want that interfered with. Instead of the Philistines parading the ark on a victory march through their country, it seems that God is marching through their country in judgment. And that's what his heavy hand is pointing to. Each time someone dies, God is bringing judgment before people's minds once more. Pele was probably the most talented and successful footballer there's ever been. But this past week, God's hand has been upon him, calling him to judgment. Pope Benedict XVI, too, more recently. The people of the world believe that they have more or less silenced God. that science, so-called, and reason and technology have boxed him in. But often in the Bible, and often in our lives too, God shows us he will not be boxed in. Just as man is destined to die once, and after that to face judgment, so Christ was sacrificed once to take away the sins of many people. The Philistines, by their actions here, they know that Dagon cannot save them. They're turning to their leaders for help. They're even, if you look at the very last verse of chapter 5, they're even crying out to heaven. But they're not getting rid of Dagon, nor are they turning in repentance to the worship of the one true God, the one God who is good, but who's definitely not safe. If you're already worshipping him through the death of Jesus, through his resurrection, then will you acknowledge that he is a God of judgment? And if you're not worshipping him yet, possibly some who will listen to this later, will you see, if that's the case, will you see how like the Philistines you really are? And how much without hope? The Lord humbles Dagon. The Lord brings down his heavy hand. Finally, the Lord displays his holiness. The Lord displays his holiness. After 7 months, we're told in chapter 6, verse 1, this has lasted for 7 months. 7 months of suffering. The Philistines finally decide to send the Ark of the Lord back. There's no disrespecting it now. Indeed, there's some wisdom in these opening verses of chapter 6. They even send a bizarre guilt offering with the ark to show how God has afflicted them. God's hand has been heavy on them. And commendably, they want to know if it is truly the Lord who's been among them. They even use his covenant name in chapter 6, verse 9. And they set up a test here, and they make it as hard as possible. Look at chapter 6, verse 7. Now then, get a new cart ready with two cows that have calved and have never been yoked. Hitch the cows to the cart, but take their calves away and pen them up. Take the ark of the Lord and put it on the cart, and in a chest beside it put the gold objects you're sending back to him as a guilt offering. Send it on its way, but keep watching it. If it goes up to its own territory, towards Beth Shemesh, then the Lord has brought this great disaster on us. But if it does not, then we shall know that it was not his hand that struck us, and that it happened to us by chance. Normally, cows that have just given birth will want to be reunited with their calves without delay. But what's going on here, it's a bit like Elijah drenching the sacrifice, drenching the offering with gallons of water before asking God to burn it up. It's making things much more difficult so that when God does it, people won't be able to say it happened any other way. So when the cows actually do pull the cart straight ahead, all the way back to Israel as they do, then the Philistines have to know this is God's doing. Look at verse 16 of chapter 6. The five rulers of the Philistines who are watching this whole display, the five rulers saw all this and then returned that same day to Ekron. But we have no record of these Philistine rulers singing God's praises back at home. We have no record of them pressing their people to turn to the Lord. Their superstition and their now failed false religion are too deeply ingrained. And as you read the chapter, the Israelites are delighted to have the ark back. How gracious, how merciful God is to send the ark back to them. They don't deserve it. And as you read on, you can see that they still can't stop themselves breaking God's commands, looking inside the ark, which they were forbidden to do. And so God has to strike his own people down for such a sin. Look at verse 20. The men of Beth Shemesh asked, "Who can stand in the presence of the Lord, this holy God? To whom will the ark go up from here? Is there no holiness in Israel?" Let me finish with a couple of comments. Firstly, have you ever heard the saying, "God has no hands but our hands. God has no feet but our feet"? I would imagine maybe most of you have heard that saying at some point. There is some truth in it. People who use that saying, they mean well. They mean God is pleased to use us. We can't see his hands, but he wants to use our hands. But this passage teaches us, God doesn't need us. Which one of the Israelites, or which tribe of the Israelites even, helps to bring the ark back? Not one human being. God does it all on his own. When he involves us in his work, as he wants to do, it's not for his good, it's for our good. And secondly, do we think often enough about the holiness of God? It means he's completely separate from sin. Means he's completely whole in and of himself. He doesn't need anything else to complete him. His eyes are too holy to look on sin. That's why the Father must turn his eyes away from his only Son as he pours his wrath over him on the cross. The Jewish leaders thought they'd got rid of Jesus, the Son of God, by crucifying him. And they even had the Romans put some kind of seal on his tomb so that he might stay dead. But again, the unexpected happened. They reckoned without the power, without the majesty of a God who defies all expectations. A God who is good, but who is certainly not safe. Is this the God you worship today? A God you may not always understand, but a God who you believe is building his kingdom even in this city? Are you willing to give up your small ambitions to commit yourself fully to his kingdom, to his holiness, knowing that it will cost you? Knowing he would take you further than you may want to go, but that every plan he has for you is good. Will you put your faltering hand into his righteous and holy hand at the start of this new year of his reign on earth? Let's stand as we talk to God together.